threading the angelic needle. Scathing criticism never works for me. I listen to other people thrust and parry, demolishing arguments with rapier wit. Then I try and fail to draw a single drop of blood. My dismissal of someone's argument as angels dancing on the head of a pin earns only a groan from its target. The thing about angels dancing on the head of a pin, he writes, is a fabrication foisted on scholasticism by later modernist propagandists. And history is a long game of telephone. Every year, I learn that some bit of information I treasured is entirely wrong. Once I copied out a prayer that began, "Keep us, O God, from all pettiness," and ended, "Let us not forget to be kind." I thought, you see, that it had been written by Mary Stuart, Queen of Scots, who spent 19 years locked up in a castle and was executed at the age of 44. How noble, how large-minded, nay, even saintly, those words became in that context. The poem was written by some lady named Mary Stuart. As for the dancing angels, that image delighted me, their big diaphanous wings overlapping, their long skirts held up, their angelic feet, no corns or calluses, on point above the pinhead, reflected in the metal. Uh-oh, would we see their undies? That was the old danger of patent leather shoes. But angels would never go too far. They are disembodied, thus safe. Besides, Aquinas was, on occasion, an idiot, and an influential one. His intellect built castles and ramparts whose ruins still stand midair. He thought original sin contaminated our entire nature, even our reason and will, marking us with depravity. He thought having sex for the sheer joy of reciprocity and release was a far worse sin than rape. Mothers worn thin by 8 or 10 children can thank his horror of contraception. Plus, he spent an awfully long time figuring out how male and female demons had sex. Isaac Disraeli, father of Benjamin, lost patience with him too, dryly pointing out that Aquinas could gravely debate whether Christ was not an hermaphrodite and whether there are excrements in paradise. For the reader desirous of being merry with Aquinas's angels, Disraeli offered Memoirs of the Extraordinary Life, Works, and Discoveries of Martinus Scriblerius, published in 1741 by an anonymous group of wits that included Jonathan Swift and Alexander Pope. The parody asks many questions, among them, how many angels can dance on the point of a very fine needle without jostling one another? Heartened, I check on my angels just to be sure. First correction, they do not dance on a pinhead. They dance on the point of a needle, which would require far more balance and dexterity from most of us, although I suppose pure spirit keeps its equilibrium. Second, the phrase was originally used in a theological context by 17th century Protestants, good old Wikipedia tells me, to mock medieval scholastics such as Duns Scotus and Thomas Aquinas. With the 1637 publication of Religion of Protestants, William Chillingworth accused such folk of debating whether a million of angels may not fit upon a needle's point. Even earlier, William Sclater, a divine in the Anglican Church, accused scholastic philosophers of obsessing over such pointless questions as whether angels did occupy a place, and so whether many might be in one place at one time, and how many might sit on a needle's point, and 600 such like needless points. Later writers suggested that needle's point was a pun signaling a needless point. Ah, but wait. Whether medieval scholastics really discussed the topic is, however, a matter of debate, Wikipedia continues. I bet they did. Angels inhabited their world, existing in a medieval mist that would soon be dispelled by hard, metallic reason. Aquinas did ponder the underlying question, can several angels be in the same place? The practical Protestants probably decided to have some fun with that. Maybe they'd read the 14th century mystical text, the Svester Catrae, that said, in heaven a thousand souls can sit on the point of a needle. Dorothy Sayers took the question of angels, tightly squeezed or layered, quite lightly, as those who shift from theology to detective fiction usually do. The question was just a debating exercise, she said. Angels are pure intelligences, not material, but limited, so that they have location in space, but not extension. They are in particular places, but insubstantially, taking up no space and sucking no air from the room. Angels dancing would be like people thinking. Millions of thoughts could flood a single object, and millions of angels could dance. Narrating as God, Frances McDormand inserted a complication. Over the years, a huge number of theological man hours have been spent debating the question, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin? To answer it, we need information. Firstly, angels don't dance. It's one of the distinguishing characteristics that marks an angel. So, none. At least, nearly none. Aziraphale had learned a dance called the gavotte in a discreet gentleman's club in Portland Place in the late 1880s. After a while, he had become fairly good at it and was quite put out when, some decades later, the gavotte went out of style for good. Fun, but McDormand as God is wrong. How could any entity be pure, weightless spirit and not dance? An angel's entire movement would be a dance, because angels can fall into perfect harmony with the universe, not get dragged down by illness or tugged this way and that for attention. Why do we care enough to argue any of this, even in fun, let alone with earnestness? Why have thousands of people lavished time and brilliance on a question so silly and irrelevant? Because it forces us to define angels, I suppose, which forces us to either rethink or reinforce our assumptions about the universe. How is it structured? What are the rules of its physics? Uncertainty now. Quantum randomness. We have moved well away from Aquinas's whipped-up certitudes. Now we lavish time and brilliance on any tiny thing that will distract us from how little we know of immensity. Any tiny thing we can argue about without cutting too close to the bone.